Penguin Random House Audio presents Gertrude and Claudius by John Updike. Read for you by John Lee. To Martha. De desirmos cors no fina vasea renciu passam. Forward. The names in part one are taken from the account of the ancient Hamlet legend in the Historia Danica of Saxo Grammaticus, the late 12th century Latin text first printed in Paris in 1514. The spellings in part two come from the fifth volume of François de Belforest's Histoire Tragique, a free adaptation of Saxo printed in Paris in 1576. Sir Israel Gollancz's Sources of Hamlet, 1926, reprints the 1582 edition and translated into English in 1608. Probably as a result of Shakespeare's play's popularity. The name Carambis occurs in the first quarto version, 1603, and recurs as Carambis in the German Der bestrafte Brudermord oder Prinz Hamlet aus Dänemark, first printed in 1781 from a lost manuscript, dated 1710, a much-shortened debasement of Shakespeare's play or of the lost so-called Ur-Hamlet from the 1580s, plausibly conjectured to be by Thomas Kidd, and to have been acquired for reworking by the Chamberlain's men, the theatrical company to which Shakespeare, whose names are used in Part 3, belonged. Part 1. The king was irate. His daughter, Geruta, though but a plump 16, had voiced reluctance to marry the nobleman of his choice, Horvendil the Ute, a beefy warrior in every way suitable, if utes could ever suit, in marriage, a Zealand maiden born and reared in the royal castle of Elsinore. "To disobey the king is treason," Rorik admonished his child, the roses in whose thin-skinned cheeks flared with defiance and distress. "When the culprit is the realm's only princess," he went on, "the crime becomes incestuous and self-injuring." "In every way suitable to you," Geruta said, pursuing her own instincts, shadows chased into the far corners of her mind by the regal glare her father cast. "But I found him unsubtle." "Unsubtle? He has all the warrior wit a loyal Dane needs. Horvendil slew the tormentor of our coasts, King Coll of Norway, by taking his long sword in two hands, thus baring his own chest. But before he could be stabbed there, he shattered Cole's shield and cut off the Norseman's foot so the blood poured clean out of him. As he lay, turning the sands beneath him into mud, Cole bargained the terms of his funeral, which his young slayer granted graciously."
"I suppose that could pass for nicety," said Geruta, "in the dark old days, when the deeds of the sagas were being wrought, and men and gods and natural forces were all as one."
Rorik protested. "Horvendil is a thoroughly modern man, my battlemate Gervindil's worthy son. He has proven a most apt co-governor of Jutland with his rather less prepossessing brother, Feng. An apt governor, solus, I might say, since Feng is forever off in the south, fighting on behalf of the Holy Roman Emperor, or whoever else trusts his arm and his agile tongue. Fighting and whoring, it is said. The people love him. Horvendil. They do not love Feng."
"The very qualities that make for public love," Geruta responded, her rosy blush slowly subsiding as the moment of most heated opposition between father and daughter passed, "may impede love in private. In our fleeting contacts, Horvendil has treated me with an unfeeling standard courtesy, as a court ornament whose real worth derives from my kinship with you. Or else he has looked through me entirely, with eyes that see only the rivalrous doings of other men. This is the gallant who, having laid coal and sufficient gold on the buried black ship to the next life, pursued and butchered the slain man's sister, Sella, with no merciful allowance for the frailty of her sex.
Sella was a warrior, a rover, to equal a man. She deserved a man's death." The phrase piqued Geruta.
"Is a woman's death less than a man's, I wonder? I think death for both is exactly as big as it must be, like the moon when it blackens the sun, to eclipse life completely, even to the last breath, which perhaps will be a sigh over opportunities wasted and happiness missed. Sella was a rover, but no woman wants to be a mere piece of furniture, to be bartered for and then sat upon.
So defiant a formula, emerging from his fair daughter's flushed face, lifted Rorik's tangled half-grey eyebrows in synchrony with his upper lip, from which a long, limp moustache drooped. His lip stopped lifting as his instinctive indulgent laugh was checked and hardened by the pressure of royal policy into a snarl. He was reminding himself to be stern. His mouth looked meaty and twisty and red between his moustache and his uncombed, grizzled beard. He would have been ugly had he not been her father. "Since your mother's untimely death, my dear child, your happiness has been my supreme concern. But I have pledged you to Hovindil, and if a king's word is broken, the kingdom cracks. All the 3 years when Horvendil roved, seizing trophies from Cole's hoard and Sella's palace and a dozen or more fat ports of Swetland and Rus, he allowed me as his liege lord the pick of the plunder."
"And I am to be the plunder in exchange," Garuda observed. She was an ample, serene, dewy and sensible girl. Had her beauty a flaw, it was a small gap between her front teeth, as if too broad a smile had once pulled the space forever open. Her hair, unbound as became a virgin, was the red of copper diluted by the tin of sunlight. A warmth surrounded her, an aura noticeable since infancy. Her nurses, in the icy, straw-floored chambers of Elsinore, had loved to clasp the resilient little body to their breasts. Bracelets of twisted bronze, brooches worked into a maze of interlaced ribbons, and a heavy necklace of thin-beaten silver scales bespoke a father's lavishing love. Her mother, Ona, had died on the farthest verge of memory, when the child was 3, and feverish with the same ague that carried off the frail mother while sparing the sturdy child. Ona had been dark, a Wendish captive. An unsmiling face with lowered lids and thick brows, a melody sung with an accent even a toddler could recognize as strange, and a touch of tender but chilly fingers formed the bulk of maternal treasure Garuta held in her memory. She was pleased now to hear, in her father's mention of Sella, that women can be warriors. She felt warrior blood within her, warrior pride, warrior daring. There was a time, 3 or 4 years after her mother's death, when she thought that she and the children whom, in the absence of brothers and sisters she played with, the children of courtiers and retainers, of ladies-in-waiting, even of the kitchen thralls in the informal rustic arrangements of Elsinore, were of the same status. Then she became aware, long before puberty had awoken any urge to mate, of her father's blood regal within her. In the absence of a brother, she stood nearest the throne, this nearness to be assumed by the man whom she would marry. So some of the power of state was hers, in this mismatched struggle of wills. Her father asked her, "What distinct fault have you found in Horvendil?" "None, which is perhaps a fault in itself. I am told that a wife completes a man. Horvendil feels himself complete already."
"No unwived man feels so, though he may not proclaim it," said Rorik, himself unwived, in a grave voice. Was this meant to soften her, so she could be bent more easily to his command? That she would eventually yield, both knew. He was a king, all substance, in essence immortal, and she of an evanescent loveliness, negligible amid the historical imperatives of dynasty and alliance.
"Truly," Rorik pleaded, "is there no chance of Horvendil pleasing you? Have you already such strict notions of what a husband should be? Believe me, Gernota, in the rough world of men, he is a more than fine specimen. He sees his duties and keeps his vows. Since your veins carry kingship in them, I have chosen for you a man fit to be king."
He dropped his voice, with its cunning political range of threat and entreaty, into a register of irresistible gentleness.
my dear daughter.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?